This is the takeaway for Monday, March 5th, 2018. And if you like the podcast, hit us with a subscribe on iTunes and give us a rating while you're there. It really helps us. And thanks.
On May 2nd of last year, the Pukri family thought their day had come. A form letter had arrived from the Diversity Immigrant Visa Program, also known as the Green Card Lottery. 20 million people apply for permanent residency through the Green Card Lottery, and only 50,000 are selected every year. It's a long shot, but the Pukris have applied almost every year since they came to the United States from Albania 17 years ago.
Happiest day of our life, actually. We thought, this is it. Everything we've been working so hard for, sacrificing for, finally happened.
That's Bepin, the oldest son in the Pukri family. He's about to be 27. His brother Michael is 21. Their mom is Neta. And the youngest is Angela. She's 10 and a U.S. citizen. And dad, his name is Vitor.
Every year we check. I checked mine, my diversity visa. I didn't win anything. I was like, nothing new there, you know. My mom checks, nothing. My brother checks, nothing. Check my father's last. Congratulations, you've been selected. I'm like, wait, what? My mom was over there washing dishes. I'll never forget it. Honestly, God, I will never forget it.
And when he came home, I told him, I was like, look, Daddy, look what I got from school. And he started reading it, and he's like, what is this? He was so confused. And I was like,
keep reading. And he couldn't believe it. Honestly, he couldn't believe it himself.
After 17 years, that disbelief kind of just sits in your heart. My father spent sleepless nights preparing everything, all the paperwork with my brother.
Like, there's a whole checklist of the things you need in order to qualify for this. And my father had all those. She's making plans. She's like, oh, she's like, first thing I'm going to do is we're going to have a party over here. We're going to celebrate.
Yeah, we're that's gonna... what I was thinking. We were happy in the beginning.
The Pukris were given an appointment date, February 6th, just last month. It should have been the final step in the green card process, what they thought was a formality, an interview with immigration.
The morning of, my mom's playing music on YouTube, you know, like so much excitement. My father's in the other room making sure every paper is straight because he is the most organized person. There's just tears dripping onto the pages. And just sat there and took it in. And we got ready. It was like 7 in the morning when we started driving because he also likes to be early. We handed in the paper. She's like, okay. The lady was like, okay, take a seat. We'll be with you shortly. Then we had to wait until almost 3 o'clock, from 8 in the morning to 3 o'clock. Everyone came and went, and it was just us. Then she finally called us in, this woman, and we walked with her to the end of the hall. She was very, very cold. And my mom asked her, hey, so do you have any kids? I don't share personal information. It was just... But my dad was like, it's okay, calm down, you know, like, we're just here to, you know.
For what we
came here for.
Yeah.
She's like, I'll be right back. I need to go scan your licenses. And then she showed up with two ICE agents. And the only thing I remember is my dad standing there with, like, his papers in his hands. He was trying to give her the papers because she was clearly not paying attention to any of them. He was just holding them in his hands. He's like, please, I have a family. And that woman gave the most disgusting sorry I've ever heard. She was like, sorry, wish you the best. And I just looked at... I was frozen. I was in shock. I just looked her in her eyes. How could you do that? We have everything. Everything. And then the ICE agents, they just kind of told me, like, nothing. They just said, go outside. We're taking your parents, pretty much.
Today, how one family copes with potential deportation and the reality that they may soon be torn apart. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Producer Oliver Lazarus has the Pukri story.
Vitor and Neta Pukri are facing deportation. They've been in the U.S. since 2001. Like many immigrant families, their status is now mixed. The visa they arrived on expired in 2002. Their two sons are DACA recipients and, at least for now, can stay in the country, work, and go to school. Their daughter is an American citizen. I visited the Pukri family at their home in Clifton, New Jersey.
Hey, Mike.
Hey, what's going on?
Hey, how are you? Good. How's it going?
Good, thank you.
The beginning, we were very well off in Albania, to be honest with you. We were happy. But, you know, it was a lot of problems started going on in Albania with after the communist regime was over. Everything started breaking out. In 1997, they had the arms break.
Everybody got the arms. And even when I was going to work, people used to shoot, even kids. And you thought something going to come and hit you. But my husband was pro-Democratic Party all the time because one of his brothers left the country when it was a communist regime, it was in 1987. And since then, started persecution on him. They took him from school and sent him, how did their name say it?
Internment.
Internment? Yeah. Oh, okay. Internment. They sent him, they told him you have to go for court, something, and they put him in jail for 3 months.
Eventually, Vitor was released from jail. He and Neta married and had 2 kids in Albania. For the most part, they were happy and successful, but Vitor's political affiliations made him a target.
My mom used to work at like a post office kind of thing. Like she used to, like, you know, as an accountant, she was working there as well. And my father would go every night and get her. There was instances where literally they held an AK-47 to my father's chest.
That's true. When he came home, he was completely yellow. I said, "What happened?" He said, "We had gun, me and this guy were sitting over there and some people came with mask on their head and
they threatened them. They looked like they were there to rob the store, but they weren't there to rob the store. They literally were.
Yeah.
Not only they robbed the store, they threatened them because of their political belief. You know, it was at that moment that my father, because we were pretty, as I said, we're pretty well off over there, but it was at that moment that my father realized that in order for our kids to have a future in this country, we must leave this corruption. So they filed for a visa. They were granted a visa. They came to America. We all got united to America, actually. You know, my father, he's a veterinarian. He was also working as a veterinarian in Albania. And he was working as like a health, from the health department, you know. He was working as an inspector, actually, in Albania. Yeah. He had his own chauffeur and everything. But he's like, we need to leave this behind because it's too much corruption. When we came here, you know, right away we wanted to become legal. So he hired a lawyer right away, tried to put the process through, try to become legal, try to live in this country for good, make this our home, which we've been doing the past 2 decades. My father started working as a dishwasher, you know. You come in with an 8-year degree from another country where school is like impossible. You know, it really is hard. And you're a veterinarian, highly respected.
Graduated at the top of your class, and first they don't accept your license because you don't have a green card. And then second off, you're working 16-hour shifts in the back of the kitchen somewhere, washing dishes.
He knows 5 different languages. He's more than a dishwasher. But to get away from the problems in Albania and to provide for the family here, he's willing to do anything. Start working construction, start working as a truck driver to provide, you know. In order for me to go to school, I had to have 2-3 jobs to pay my school through. In hopes of one day, we're going to get the papers and we're going to be fine. You know what I mean?
It's very sad because I love this country with everything in me. And at one point, I wanted to join the Marines. And for it to just turn you down and just step on you, it's really, really sad. And
we have a lot of faith. You know, honestly, we invested, like I said, 2 decades in here. You know, this is our home.
The Pukri family says their lives would be at risk if they returned to Albania, but they might not have a choice. At their February 6th immigration appointment, Vitor was taken into ICE custody. He's currently being held in detention a few miles away from their home at the Elizabeth Detention Center. Neta was allowed to return home to be with her kids, but she's being monitored with an ankle bracelet.
I feel like I'm not a criminal to have this, and I feel kind... Why and
it's like
ashamed
you
of?
That's what it is. It's, you know, you have a mother of 3 kids. Like this is for people that are like literally like and they get caught with drugs and like they're on like house arrest and whatnot. You have a mother of 3 kids working as a
trying to make a living for your kids and working. Kind of feel ashamed. That's why. Actually, when I go to work, sometimes I hide it. You know, do you see my pants?
She has like the white pants.
I bought the white pants for that reason. That's. It's not fun. But they don't need to put this thing on me. I'm not going anywhere. I love this country. If I go somewhere, it's going to be my country. nowhere else.
This is your country. What do you mean, my country?
I know, but they don't want me here. They don't want me here. The only thing we did is we love this country. We love this country with all our heart.
It's tough, man. It really is tough. You know, now, especially now that, you know, my father was working. He was making good money as a truck driver. He was paying for most of the bills. He was helping my brother pay for his school while my brother's going to school. And I'm still paying my student loan, my huge student loan that I have. And now that he's gone, I have to put my student loan on hold and cover all the bills myself. You know, my mom, she's trying to help, but she can't because she has the ankle brace on, so she's very limited to the days she can work and what she can do. And, you know, she's being treated like a criminal. She has to be very careful with what she does. It's that fear of, like, okay, what are they going to come and get me now? Or what's going to happen tomorrow? Or what are they going to do with me and my kids? Or are they going to separate us? What if I open up my restaurant and I get deported tomorrow? What happens?
You need that peace of mind. Nobody understands it, how much we need it, actually. I hope.
The one thing that really, really broke me as a person about this country was when my mom asked them about my sister, actually. She's like, what happens with my daughter? You guys are trying so hard to, like, send us back like we're criminals trying to separate us. But my daughter's born here. She's a U.S. citizen. What happens with her? Oh, well, either she comes with you or social services. You're willing to take those drastic measures to put a child in social services?
No, I'm not going to let you.
I don't know what it is.
Okay, I'm not going to let you. Don't worry.
You know.
No, you're going to be fine. We have God.
No, this is just one story. There's so many stories out there, you know. It really sucks because for us, the papers and the green card not only meant becoming legal in this country, it meant literally striving for greatness. My dad still has plans, if he was to get out of there with a green card, to go back to school, finish his three classes that he needs to open up his own practice as a veterinarian. I want to go back to school. After all this is over, I want to be a lawyer. I wanted to be a pharmacist. But after this, knowing what we've been through and the struggle that we struggled, if everything comes out well after this, I'd definitely go for law school.
But even with their ambitions, the Pukri family remains entangled in this country's immigration system. They have been for the better part of 20 years, moving from Michigan to New Jersey in 2010 to avoid the threat of deportation. But for all the talk of immigration and national politics since then, it wasn't until this past election, in 2016, that they found themselves engaged in politics for the first time.
When Trump was elected, what did you guys think about him?
Oh, God, I made everybody to vote for him. I wanted him to win so badly.
It's kind of like
it sucks.
It sucks because everybody's telling me, do you see what is happening with you now? If you asked on my job, even a guy used to call me like I'm Mrs. Trump. called me because they knew it. I really wanted so badly to win.
People that knew our situation would laugh at us.
They were against Trump because of us. Because they knew it. We didn't have documents and his policies. They were against. They said, for me? No, you have to vote and make other people who thought I have documents. You should vote for him because it's this.
No, it was so funny because people were against him because of people in our situation. But us were like, no. Yeah. We were the people supporting
it's
this.
It's something,
know?
Yeah. It A guy called funny. Me from Germany. Actually, he left the country because he didn't have family here. I worked with him. He called me, he said, I heard this and this for your documents. I said, yeah. And he said, I told you that guy going to deport people. I said, what are you going to do?
Yeah. It sucks. It really sucks. Like I said, our circumstances suck, but we believe it's best for the country. At the end of the day, honestly, that's what matters, is making America great again. We believe that.
Vitor and Neta don't have a court date set. But while they wait, the rest of the family is doing what they can to stay together.
I love my kids like every mom.
What bonds you guys? What do you guys do together?
Movies.
Everything. Actually, everything. We go for dinner together. We go on movies together. We go bowling. When we go bowling?
Mostly comedies on here. Like comedies. King of Queens.
Yeah. I like spending time with my kids. Yeah. I stayed with them till 2 morning. you know, talking, sometimes giving advice, sometimes listening.
They were always very involved in our in our life, you know.
I loved them in our decision making.
We like to joke around a lot. And we're always, we always have like that positive mood.
Not always. We look, I consider this my own. I told you, I plan on opening up my own business. I plan on doing stuff. I really have high dreams for this place, and we really hope that we would be united as one here. I would hate to see my family deported back to Albania in a country where we have no future, especially for her. Like, my little sister's born here. She's never been to Albania. She barely speaks any Albanian. It's not fair.
I speak a little bit, though.
Yeah. For her to return to Albania at this age, it would be a sin. We would hate to leave her alone. But she has her whole future, like, in front of her.
I hope God's going to help me to stay with my family together here, legal.
For The Takeaway, I'm Oliver Lazarus.
We reached out to ICE for comment on the Pukri situation, and they sent us this statement. Both Neda Pukri and Vitor Pukri had previous orders of removal from the United States dating back to 2004, which in the case of both was upheld by two different appellate courts. On February 6th, ICE arrested both individuals based on their final orders of removal. Vitor Pukri is currently in ICE custody, and Neda Pukri has been enrolled in the agency's Alternatives to Detention program. That's a statement from ICE on the Pukri's case. This is The Takeaway. President Donald Trump's administration has been aggressive in pulling back regulations enacted or proposed by his predecessor, President Obama. President Trump has gone as far as to say that any new regulation has to be paired with canceling two other regulations. The Trump administration has gone after regulations across the government in environment, healthcare, financial services, consumer protections. And then there's the administration's strategy when it comes to transportation safety. And whether it's cars, trucks, and buses on the road, or planes, trains, other infrastructure, the administration is hard at work rescinding or delaying safety rules put in place over the last few years. In most cases, the industry loves these pullbacks. And the effects on people's safety is less clear. Transportation reporter Joan Lowy worked on an investigation of the rules under the Trump administration for the Associated Press. She starts with rules requiring wireless communication between cars to avoid collisions.
Well, right at the end of the Obama administration, the Department of Transportation had issued a proposed rule that they'd been working on for years and said, this is what we want to do. We want to require automakers to include this technology for vehicles to wirelessly communicate with each other in order to avoid collisions. It's a concept that people in transportation safety are very excited about. It's one of the most promising technologies. But now under Trump, it's been moved from what they call the White House list of active rulemakings to its long-term agenda, which basically means they don't anticipate any action on it for at least 12 months and probably longer. And the auto industry wants this rule, actually.
There's another rule that would have required hybrid cars to emit a sound when they're traveling at low speed. They're electric at that speed and they're silent. Joan, I have a hybrid car myself, and I always sort of fantasized that it would make a sound like a Jetsons car when I'm in a parking lot, really, because people can't hear you coming. And this was actually the subject of a proposed rule. What happened there?
Well, this is a rule that was worked on for a long time, but because it was in this window right before the Trump administration took over, that you're allowed to, the new administration is allowed to sort of freeze previous regulations to review them again. The final rule got frozen. And just last week, the Department of Transportation issued a notice saying that it was granting a petition from automakers to delay the implementation, the requirement that those sounds be added to cars so that they don't have to be added until September of 2020.
Joan, in this case, is there any argument from the administration about why it's a bad idea for electric or hybrid cars to have to emit a sound so that people know they're coming?
They're not saying it's a bad idea. I mean, their rationale for delaying this is they got this request from automakers that automakers said they weren't ready, that this will save automakers money by delaying it. They look at this as an item of regulatory relief, as they call it.
Joan, let's talk about sleep apnea and the sleep that operators of trains or heavy trucks or buses get. What's going on with rulemaking when it comes to sleep?
Well, the National Transportation Safety Board, which investigates a lot of these big accidents, has investigated 13 accidents that involving they're either highway accidents or train accidents, in which a primary cause of the accident was the operator's undiagnosed sleep apnea. And these were some big ones. You remember in 2013, there was a commuter train that was coming around a curve and the operator, the engineer didn't brake, and it went off the tracks, it derailed, and four passengers were thrown out of the cars and killed, and dozens more were injured, some of them very seriously. And that was a case of undiagnosed sleep apnea. We've had two other commuter train accidents in New York and New Jersey that were almost identical, and also, again, engineers with undiagnosed, you know, obstructive sleep apnea. And then there have been multiple highway accidents. There was one in Palm Springs, California, in which a truck hit a bus and 13 people were killed and quite a few others were injured. The NTSB also cited sleep apnea as the primary cause.
What did the Obama administration try to do when it comes to sleep deprivation and sleep apnea?
So they had started work on this the year before Trump was elected. And then last August, after Trump had been in office about 7 months, they withdrew, formally withdrew that rulemaking, and they're not going to work on it anymore. They said at the time that there were already programs in existence to address this and that there was another rulemaking on fatigue in the railroad industry that would address this. But, you know, the NTSB, when they had a recent hearing on the two accidents in New York and New Jersey, the train ones that involve sleep apnea, were very skeptical of that explanation because these accidents keep coming. So it's obvious they're not being addressed. And the fatigue rulemaking is years overdue and not moving anywhere.
Do we have a sense, do researchers have a sense, that by stopping some of these rules, cars, trucks, buses, or trains, whether safety itself will be impacted, whether there could be more accidents and more people could be injured or killed?
It's very hard to say. These are very rare accidents. So we don't know necessarily whether by not taking these actions, we're going to get more of these accidents. We just don't know. Other things, it's more predictable. For instance, if the government established, according to DOT's own analysis, established a 60-mile-per-hour maximum speed limit for trucks, you know, you could save an estimated 500 lives a year, or nearly that many. On the other hand, the trucking industry is arguing against the rule and saying, we think that these maximum speed limits would create dangerous differentials in speeds between cars and trucks and lead to accidents.
So, Joan, what's to be gained here from the perspective of the Trump administration? I mean, some of these rules, in the case of cars and collision avoidance, you're talking about a rule that the industry itself said it wanted. Is this just a philosophical opposition to government rules? Is it a drive to undo anything the Obama administration did? Has the Trump administration said, here's why we don't want hybrids to have to make a noise in a parking lot, for instance?
This really isn't a case of the Trump administration trying to undo everything that the Obama administration did. In most cases, these rules are opposed by powerful industries. Some of them don't want the rules at all, or they want the rules changed, they want them tweaked in some way. And it seems that the changes that the Trump administration is proposing coincide with the desires of industry.
Joan Lowy, transportation reporter for the Associated Press. Joan, thanks so much.
Thanks very much for having me.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. 90 miles from Jackson, Mississippi, in the city of Meridian, you'll find the East Mississippi Correctional Facility for Men. It's one of three privately run prisons in the state, and here, a majority of the inmates suffer from mental illness. But according to the plaintiffs in a class action lawsuit going to trial today, these inmates also suffer extreme abuse and neglect.
The lawsuit details people having to go to the bathroom in styrofoam plates, lights not working in cells, lights always on in cells. Solitary confinement was used as a way to quell those who were dealing with seizures or serious other mental health disorders. Sometimes people were in cells by themselves for 23 hours a day and only on some days got to come out to take a shower.
That's Ariel Dreher, news reporter at the Jackson Free Press. Civil rights groups and inmates both allege that Mississippi failed to hold private prison contractors accountable while inhumane conditions persisted for years at East Mississippi Correctional Facility.
These types of instances sort of culminated in two deaths that are listed in the lawsuit. In 2010, a man named Richard Rowe died in his cell after staff sort of neglected to let him come out. He suffered from both mental health and serious other medical issues that required him to take a daily shower, but he wasn't allowed to because of the solitary confinement policies. And in pretty gruesome detail, the lawsuit describes him literally being taken from his solitary confinement cell with his feet bound by zip ties, and he was pronounced dead later at the hospital. That was in 2010. The SPLC, the Southern Poverty Law Center, and the ACLU Prison Project started investigating in 2011, and they filed their lawsuit in 2013.
What are conditions like at East Mississippi Correctional Facility now? Have they changed since these groups started paying attention and writing lawsuits?
So that was one of the questions I asked attorneys last week, and their thoughts were things have gotten not quite better. One attorney referred to it as consistent chaos. There have been four deaths in the facility in the last 2 months, they said. So I'm not sure that everything has necessarily gotten better. I think it's a little bit more under control, perhaps, than it was back then. But for background information, the Department of Corrections in Mississippi is on their third contractor to provide mental health care and medical care in the facility. So there are or have been indications that at least the department has switched contractors, but it doesn't sound like, based on the attorneys who were in the facility just last week, that conditions have gotten that much better.
You mentioned that four people have died in the prison over the last 2 months. Do we know why? Were those deaths preventable?
One attorney last week detailed one of those deaths was just a man choking on his lunch that staff couldn't get to him in time to help him out. And he also said that they had confirmed two of those deaths were due to drug overdoses. And a lot of the lawsuit details not just mental health care that's missing, which is important because I should note that the majority of inmates housed at East Mississippi Correctional Facility do have mental health issues. But it's not just mental health care that's lacking. It's also just regular medical care, too.
And what does the lawsuit allege about that mental health care that the facility is supposed to be providing?
It alleges that they're not even doing the basic things like monitoring medication that patients are on, tracking what they need, and also just the use of solitary confinement as a practice is not good mental health care practice or good medical practice in general. And so the lawsuit really goes in on that use of solitary confinement as being something that should not even exist in the facility.
What's the history of this facility? You mentioned that three different companies have run this prison for the state of Mississippi so far.
It has for a long time been used as sort of the place where any inmate, including minors who are being transferred from the state's youthful offender unit, are sent if they're thought to have any sort of mental health issues. So, of course, in terms of a state facility that needs to have the best mental health care, it would definitely need to be this facility. And I think, as a side note here that's important, the state of Mississippi is also being sued by the federal government for our adult mental health care system in general, not even in the prisons. So Mississippi and mental health care challenges go way back in this state.
And we have covered that federal suit against Mississippi for its public mental health system as well. These two things sort of coming together here. Ariel, this is a privately run prison by a company called MTC, Management Training Corporation. We reached out to MTC. They sent us a statement. It's long, but it says in part, while we can't speak to specific allegations because the case is in court, we can say unequivocally that the facility is safe, secure, clean, and well run. From the warden on down, our staff are trained to treat the men in our care with dignity and respect. Our mission is to help these men make choices in prison and after they're released that will lead to new and successful lives in society. MTC says they've made significant improvements over the last few years in security and staffing and other areas. Does the evidence reflect that?
I think that that's what we're going to find out this week in trial. And it should be noted, this lawsuit is against the Mississippi Department of Corrections, not necessarily against the contractors. And so what we're seeing is these legal organizations bringing this case, and it's a class action lawsuit on behalf of all the prisoners at the facility. But they're really asking MDOC, the Mississippi Department of Corrections, to hold their contractors accountable. And I think it's an interesting sort of taxpayer case, if you will, because these are taxpayer dollars paying for these contractors. And if, in fact, what the lawsuit alleges is true, taxpayer dollars are not being used well at the facility.
Ariel Dreher, news reporter for the Jackson Free Press, who will be following this trial, civil rights organizations and prisoners in Mississippi suing the state, and by extension, its private contractors, the East Mississippi Correctional Facility for Men. Ariel, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for having me.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is in Washington today, meeting with President Trump before speaking at this year's AIPAC conference. That's the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. They're the strongest group of conservative supporters of Israel. It might be business as usual for Netanyahu on the international stage and in the Oval Office, but he's got turmoil at home. On Friday, Israeli police questioned Netanyahu and his wife for 5 hours at their home in Jerusalem. Police have already recommended indictments against the prime minister in 2 corruption cases. This questioning on Friday reportedly related to a 3rd corruption case. Ruth Eglash is Jerusalem correspondent for The Washington Post, traveling with Netanyahu on his trip to the United States.
The 3rd case that he was questioned on Friday morning is involving the Israeli telecom giant Bezeq. And the allegations against him say that he made special regulations for Bezeq over the years that he served as communications minister simultaneously to being prime minister in exchange for positive or favorable coverage from a news website called Walla that is owned by the same person who was a majority shareholder in Bezeq.
And Ruth, these other 2 cases where police have recommended indictments, we've talked about them in months past on this show, but give us a refresher, remind us of those recommendations.
The first one involves gifts that were given to Netanyahu of a very high value, millions of dollars, in exchange for certain favors for wealthy businessmen and wealthy people who live outside of Israel. And the second case is to do with a deal that was supposedly discussed between the prime minister and the publisher of one of the most popular Israeli daily newspapers called Yediot Ahronot. And in those 2 cases, the police have finished their investigations, as far as we know, and they have sent their findings to the attorney general, recommending that he launch an indictment against Netanyahu.
So, Ruth, you mentioned it. Police have only recommended indictments here. When will Netanyahu know if he's going to be indicted, if he might be charged?
That's anyone's guess right now. It's up to really all in the hands of the Attorney General. He has to decide whether to indict the Prime Minister, when to indict it. And obviously, it's a very sensitive issue. It involves great upheaval in Israel. All the pressure's on the Attorney General to decide that. So that just remains to be seen over the next few weeks.
What has this done to politics in Israel? What's the main effect? Is Netanyahu able to govern in situations like this? You know, people who would like to take his place start to gather in the wings. What's going on?
Well, you know, he has a very, very strong coalition in Israel. The coalition partners realize that they need him just as much as he needs them if they want to stay in the governing body of the country. So at the moment, his partners have been very supportive. They've said, we'll wait and see what the Attorney General has to say.
Ruth, this is a cloud over Benjamin Netanyahu as he visits the United States, as he often does, meeting with the president, speaking to AIPAC. What's the main item on the agenda between Netanyahu and American supporters, strong supporters of Israel?
Well, for Netanyahu, this visit is very important. I mean, this is sort of like his, you know, his support base in AIPAC. He's very popular. And that can also be applied to his meeting with President Trump. These are very high level points for Netanyahu to show his supporters, look, even though I have these investigations going on, I can still do my job. I can still go to Washington. I can still meet with President Trump. I can still go to AIPAC where people cheer for me. So these are all very good public displays for Prime Minister Netanyahu.
Ruth Eglash, Jerusalem correspondent for The Washington Post, traveling with Benjamin Netanyahu as he visits the United States under a legal cloud at home. Ruth, thank you.
You're welcome.
Let's go back to West Virginia now. We visited last week when a statewide teacher's strike looked like it could be ending. Now that strike is in day 12, and it's gone from a local story to a national one. Close to 20,000 teachers are still off the job. Jake Jarvis is staff writer at the State Journal. He's been following the negotiations. He joins us now from Charleston, West Virginia. Jake, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Jake, last week we heard from some teachers that they were ready to go back to work in the classroom. I got to say, when you and I talked last week, I didn't think that we would necessarily be talking this week. What happened?
So Governor Jim Justice struck a deal with leaders of the teacher unions to give teachers a 5% raise and to officially create a task force with education officials on it to look at their health insurance. So that was the deal, and the West Virginia House of Delegates agreed to the deal. They passed a bill pretty quickly after the deal came out to give teachers that 5% raise. When the bill got over to the Senate, totally fell apart. Senators said that the money's not there. They can't support giving teachers that much money. So instead, they pulled it back to 4%. And union leaders said that 4% is not enough. That's not the deal they made. Coincidentally, the Senate accidentally passed a bill to give them 5%, had to pull it back at the last minute to change it to 4% and then send it forward. It was a really chaotic Saturday night here in West Virginia.
An accidental passing of a bill, it sounds chaotic. Jake, the difference between 5% and 4% across the state, how much money are we talking about? You told us last week that teachers just don't make much in West Virginia.
So we're talking about $13 million in a $4 billion budget. That's the difference between a 5% raise and a 4% raise. So I talked to some leaders of the Senate Finance Committee who say that that $13 million is going to be given to other public employees to make sure that they can get a raise. And the unions and teachers feel like the Senate's pitting public sentiment against teachers and against other public employees. We got two groups here, and they feel like they're being pit against one another, and they don't feel like that should be the case.
And Jake, what's the state of play politically? When you and I talked last week, this was kind of a local story. This strike's been getting a whole lot of national attention now, and that can really change the dynamics between the parties. So what's going on?
I think teachers definitely are aware that they're getting a lot of national attention. And Governor Justice is also very aware. He's actually complained about how much attention it's gotten and that he doesn't like seeing West Virginia on the national news every night. I'm not sure if that pressure will be enough, though, to force the Senate into agreeing to the 5%. I mean, they were very, very strong. I think we would need two or three Republicans to flip and side with the Democrats for the 5% deal to go through. Right now, what's happening, though, is that since the House wouldn't agree to the change, we've got a joint conference committee coming together to try to figure something out. Now, that committee might meet Monday afternoon. It could meet Tuesday. We don't know when they'll strike a deal, if they do at all. So, I mean, this could go on the rest of the week.
What about parents? I mean, parents that may have been sympathetic to teachers who don't make much money on day three, here we are headed into the third week of a strike. Are the parents of all these kids across West Virginia supportive?
It seems like it so far. It seems like a good bit of parents are. Of course, it's so hard to gauge that sort of thing in such a rural state like West Virginia and myself being in the capital. But on Friday, more than 40 superintendents from across the state met with the governor and met with Senate President Mitch Carmichael. And many of them said that their community is on board with these teachers getting a raise. And it was so close. It seemed like it was so close to ending if the Senate would have just passed the 5%. So I think parents have recognized how close it was and that the deal was there and that it fell through because the Senate didn't pass it. So I think the sympathy is still there for the teachers. We also think that there could be legal action coming down from the state because, you know, students haven't been in class now for 12 days. The attorney general says this strike's illegal. The Department of Education has already urged teachers to go back to school. So the tensions have never been higher with this strike.
Oh, I think we might be checking in with you again, Jake Jarvis, before this is open. The teacher strike in West Virginia enters its third week. Jake Jarvis, staff writer at the State Journal in Charleston, West Virginia. Thanks, Jake.
Thanks so much for having me.
We end our show today with the final installment in our book club series, Reading the Reckoning, with WNYC's Rebecca Carroll. Here, Rebecca talks with author Tayari Jones. Tayari begins with a passage from her new novel, An American Marriage.
12 years is what they gave him. We would be 43 years old when he was released. I couldn't even imagine myself at such an age. Roy understood that 12 years was an eternity because he sobbed right there at the defendant's table. His knees gave way and he fell into his chair. The judge paused and demanded that Roy bear this news on his feet. He stood again and cried, not like a baby, but in the way that only a grown man can cry, from the bottom of his feet up through his torso and finally through his mouth. When a man wails like that, you know it's all the tears he was never allowed to shed, from Little League disappointment to teenage heartbreak, all the way to whatever injured his spirit just last year. As Roy howled, my fingers kept worrying a rough patch of skin beneath my chin, a souvenir of scar tissue. When they did what I remember as kicking in the door, what everyone else remembers as opening it with the key, after the door was open, however it was open, we were both pulled from the bed. They dragged Roy into the parking lot, and I followed, lunging for him, wearing nothing but the white slip. Someone pushed me to the ground, and my chin hit the pavement. My slip rode up, showing everything to everyone as my tooth sank into the soft skin of my bottom lip. Roy was on the asphalt beside me, barely beyond my grasp, speaking words that didn't reach my ears. I don't know how long we lay there, parallel like burial plots. Husband, wife. What God has brought together, let no man tear asunder.
Boy, that image, that whole passage, that includes so many, many things. I mean, the pavement, the asphalt, the break-in, the intrusion, the suggestion of already you can tell something unjust is going to happen. Why is that scene so pivotal in the novel?
Well, An American Marriage is a story of a young couple who they've only been married 18 months when the husband is accused of a crime he does not commit. And they're staying in a hotel at the time. And the police break into the hotel room and pull them out and arrest her husband. And that was the moment her life changed. And I thought it was interesting that it happened in a hotel because, you know, when they were in their honeymoon, they're in another hotel. Like, it's just these moments that the mirroring of these two moments, their honeymoon hotel versus this hotel where everything changed, where they're treated as criminals, where their humanity is denied.
We're calling this book series Reading the Reckoning, in part because we are in this, you know, watershed moment of Me Too and Time's Up and, you know, gender disparity, equality. Not in the books we're choosing or talking about, not necessarily dealing specifically with the reckoning, but have fallen in publication during the reckoning. And so what does it feel like as a Black woman telling the story of an African-American marriage and the prison system and mass incarceration and police brutality?
And don't forget the rape of which he's accused.
That's right.
Into the mix. I mean, I do think about this as a really intersectional novel. I don't think that you can talk about any one of these issues by themselves. Roy is an innocent man. He is wrongfully accused of rape. But, you know, he is, the woman misidentifies him. She's not lying on him. She misidentified him.
Make that clarification. She misidentifies. She's not lying.
She's not lying in that she believes that he is the person. She is wrong, but she believes that he is the person. I mean, the thing about, it's very tricky, right? Because the thing about eyewitness testimony, it is simultaneously the most convincing and also the least reliable. And, you know, there's so many stories about, like, when police show people lineups, everyone else in the lineup may be in, say, a mugshot, and then another person is not in a mugshot. That person catches your eye. The person who's different catches your eye, like when the lineup isn't uniform. Like, there's so many things that happen that lead to misidentification.
The woman who accuses him is a white woman. Is that right?
Everyone always thinks she's a white woman. I actually do not specify her race in the text. The reason I didn't is that I felt like if he is a black man accused of, I almost feel like capital R raping a capital W white woman, that then that would distract from the story, which in my mind is about him and his wife. So I didn't specify it in the novel. But in my mind, I do have a picture of her. And just to make my own life more difficult as a storyteller, in my mind, she is neither black or white because, you know, there are other people.
No, there are no other people. No. The reason I ask, of course, in the context of the reckoning and the Me Too movement and sexual assault and stories that have come forward, you know, statistically speaking, the idea of someone lying about being raped is really very small. I mean, the fact that's very, very unusual. And what also comes into play for black women and who are the victims of sexual assault by black men is what will happen to these men if they report them. So that's what I was sort of thinking, like, if this woman had been black, would she have risked making that misidentification?
And, you know, I think she may have because, you know, she says in her, when she testifies, Celestial reports, Celestial is the wife, that the woman says this was not her first time being held at the mercy of a man, but it would not be her, but this would be her last. So this is a woman who has been assaulted before. I mean, that's what makes everything so complicated. As even Celestial and even Roy says, someone hurt that woman, but it wasn't me. So this woman has been raped by someone. And I think because of that, in my mind, she has compassion for me. She is completely wrong. But that's why I did not spend a lot of time. I didn't want this novel to come down to the fact that women lie. You know, like, that was so counter to my goals in this book. I was really interested more in the reckoning between Celestial and Roy because, you know, Roy loves that he has this wife who doesn't build her life around her husband. She's this free spirit. But when he is incarcerated, he wants a traditional wife. He wants a woman who will stay chastely by, wait for him, organize her life around his pain.
And so what is the reckoning between Celestial and Roy?
I think the reckoning between Celestial and Roy is this. When Roy says to Celestial, I'm innocent. He writes in a letter, I'm innocent. And she writes back, I'm innocent too. He had never considered the fact of her innocence as well when she's trying to decide how her life will go forward after his incarceration. He just had never really thought of her as a person fully separate from himself, and that her life, that this is her one life. His one life has been in some ways, you know, stunted by him being incarcerated. And I think he believes that she should, in a way, kind of throw herself on his funeral pyre, in a way. And that is the real thing that he had to really think about, the idea that she is his wife, but she is not his property. And he had not really considered that before, really.
And do you feel like that is a very common and still contemporary modern idea that men have?
I think it's true not just for men, but women as well. I do think, particularly in the black context, with the idea that the men are so under siege, that the way that you assist them is through traditional values, right? I mean, when I was trying to write this book, the first time I wrote it from her point of view, and everyone was just mad. And I was frustrated. And then I read books by white women,
And in those books, like, there were a lot of white women writing about being in marriages that were not satisfying them. And as you can imagine, Celestial, she's been married 18 months. Her husband is in prison for 3 years with 9 more to go. That is not a satisfying. She says a marriage is more than just love. A marriage is a life, and we're not sharing the same life. And the idea that that wasn't enough for her, if this was a different person in a different context, like a husband who's away on business trips all the time and the wife wants to have an affair, you'd read it and be like, yes, girl, have that affair.
Right. I mean, but you specifically point out that if it was a white woman, that it would be different.
Yes. If it was a, or even if it was a black woman whose husband just was not present. But as her daddy tells her, that man is a hostage of the state. The least you could do, the least you could do is, you know, sacrifice your own life, your own pleasure of existence for him. And she doesn't. And that is the real, that is a serious question that I don't think has been looked at in a clear-eyed way, I think.
So that passage, you know, where Celestial says, marriage is more than love, it's a life. But who decides what the life looks like? You know, ultimately, marriage is experienced by two people who are alive and who are committed to each other. So those lives could be divergent, no?
It could be, but not for her. I mean, it's about two people who, as her father says to her, marriage is between two people. There is no studio audience. It's about what's satisfying for two people. And for her, she is not satisfied in a marriage where she doesn't ever see or touch her husband. That's why she says to him, I will continue to be here. I will continue to support you, but not as your wife. So she's not saying, I want nothing to do with you, but she's saying she doesn't feel like she's married. She doesn't feel like she was ever married. She feels like she was a bride and never got a chance to be a wife.
And what are your own feelings about marriage?
I think that marriages work if they work for both people. If both people's needs are met, the marriage works. I mean, if they're not, it's not a matter, I don't think it's a matter of right or wrong. I don't think it's right or wrong that she's dissatisfied in the marriage that she's in with her husband being incarcerated. It's just not what she wants for her life. I think that we get so judgmental and when we talk about marriage that we don't really, I think we just need to take a step back and just think about the way that people share their lives, share their responsibilities, and the way people find satisfaction. And, you know, sometimes relationships end because they're healthy. And other times, I know you know people like this, they can be in some madness for decades. Like, this is the worst, longest lasting relationship ever. So I don't think we should, definitely don't think we should count it by longevity.
I think what's extraordinary about this novel and this narrative and these characters is that it's called An American Marriage, but it's really about people. It's an American human story, and the ways in which we trust people, that we love people, that we grow and evolve. And so I find that very heartening in terms of the future. As a married person, I think of this as a way to re-explore and relive and re-identify ideas about marriage and about friendships too. There's this amazing friendship that Celestial has with her childhood friend, Andre, that takes on different forms throughout. But you've done a beautiful job here, and so I appreciate you coming to talk with us.
Well, thank you. It was a lot of fun.
The book is An American Marriage by Tayari Jones.
WNYC's Rebecca Carroll there talking to author Tayari Jones. And be sure to join us next Monday for the culmination of our book club series, Reading the Reckoning. Rebecca will be back with An American Marriage by Tayari Jones and an on-air book club with a few of you, our listeners. So if you're reading along with Rebecca, you have just 1 week to go. The Oscars went off last night successfully, this time without naming the wrong movie for Best Picture at the end of the night. A lot of the winners were expected. The Shape of Water for Best Picture, Frances McDormand for Best Actress, Gary Oldman for Best Actor in Darkest Hour. On a night when the Academy went all in promoting diversity, there was a first. Jordan Peele became the first black screenwriter to win Best Original Screenplay, of course, for Get Out. And Guillermo del Toro took home the Oscar for Best Director for The Shape of Water. It's the fourth time in 5 years that a Mexican director has won the award.
I am an immigrant, like Alfonso and Alejandro, my compadres. And in the last 25 years, I've been living in a country all of our own. Part of it is here, part of it is in Europe, part of it is everywhere. Because I think that the greatest thing our art does and our industry does is to erase the lines in the sand.
Guillermo del Toro at the Oscars last night. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.